session number 11338, Reel 3.
Wing Commander Alec Ingle, Reel 3. Yes, we were talking about this business of the personalised nature when yes. you're one-to-one.
Yes, well, it becomes an individual battle, and I think you'll find when you talk to people, everybody sees a war or a battle through their own eyes. You don't see it collectively, you see it individually. And you'll find that everybody's, you can have three or four people in one battle, and they'll all see it totally differently, and you wouldn't identify it as the same battle or the same occasion. But I think that's the nature of the thing. You see, you're alone in your aircraft, and once you're fighting, you see, you're not concerned about the radio or anything like that. You're concentrating on what you can see. I mean, nobody, once you'd been directed into the area where the enemy was, then the rest of it was up to you. And it became very much a personal thing. You know, you had to shoot him down before he shot you down. That sort of approach. So you'll find, I think this applies particularly to fighters, because you are, you know, you're controlling your own destiny in that aircraft, and you're not responsible for anybody else.
And
you've no crew.
Is there something sort of abstract about it, in as much that you're not eyeball to eyeball? You know, that it's, as you say, it's the technology you're fighting rather than the actual person.
I would have said that's a pretty fair assessment of the situation. I don't think, well, there may be some odd birds who had a personal animosity against the German pilots. I hadn't, as far as I was concerned. They were in aircraft, their job was to shoot me down, and my job was to shoot them down. And that's all there was to it. It could have been something quite impersonal in that thing. I mean, it could have been a robot in it, as far as I was concerned. If the pilot, I'd never had an occasion to sort of chase pilots down in parachutes. It would seem to me a totally unprofitable waste of time. If a character was coming down in a parachute over England and he was a German, then okay, they can easily lock him up in a prison war camp. And if he gets to the ground safely, jolly good luck to him. I think it's much more important to stick to the job in hand, which was limiting the enemy's ability to come and attack you. So it was the technology. I think you're quite right.
Your first sight of London, you know, in the East yeah. End ablaze. By the time you left, you know, you went mm. north again, I understand, didn't you?
We went to Martlesham Heath.
Yes. What did London look like from the air after these raids?
Well, I don't know. You see, whilst we were there, of course, there were considerable raids on London, and it was a shambles, but... From the height you were flying, you didn't fly over it unless it was at a considerable height, because the balloons, you see. So that I don't recall much about that, to tell you the truth, what London looked like. I can recall that in December, when I'd come out of hospital, I went home, and I can recall coming back. I lived in Cheshire, Presbury in Cheshire. I can recall arriving back in town and having to get to Croydon and having to plough my way through everybody sleeping in the tubes. And occasionally we used to nip up to town, but I wasn't particularly interested in it. London wasn't attractive as far as I was concerned. It was just a place there, and we were on the outskirts of it.
So you went back to near Coventry, I understand. Is that right, your next place?
We went to Martlesham Heath, which is near Ipswich, and we operated there for a time. And actually, I was given a flight of Hurricane 2s. That was a Hurricane with a Merlin 20 engine instead of a Merlin 3. And I had to do 600 hours flying on these six aircraft, with a number of pilots quite quickly to just to see whether there are any bugs in them. And they were, of course, very much improved aircraft and very much improved performance. And then when we'd done that at Martlesham Heath, we moved up to Turnhill. We moved into Turnhill, a bit 13 group, at Turnhill Market Drayton, near Market Drayton, which was a flying training airfield. It had all the flying training on it. We were just lodging on it for defence of the Midlands, Coventry, and around there. We tried to do some work at night, but that wasn't successful. And we used to go up to Liverpool and operate from Speke, defending Liverpool and that sort of thing. But there wasn't much, as far as we were concerned. We weren't very busy then. And then we moved to Baginton, which is just outside Coventry, where we, again, this was defence of the Midlands, and again we tried to do some work at night, but of course we weren't equipped for it. We'd no aids for night work. And then we moved to Honiley, which is just a bit further across, quite close to there. And by which time it was 1941, September 41, I was sent away on rest to 59 OTU at Carlisle, where I was principally involved in running an air firing squadron, getting people to get the idea of how to shoot things down.
That sounds to me as if your rank was higher.
I was a flight lieutenant then. I'd taken over B flight in 605 squadron. Well, I took it over when Archie McKellar, who was quite a well-known pilot, he came to us when Walter Churchill left us. He came to us as the CEO of the squadron from 602. Well, he'd come to us earlier as a flight commander when we went down to Croydon, and then he took over the squadron, and unfortunately he was killed on the 2nd of November, and I'd taken over his flight at that time. So I had a flight in whilst I was still at Croydon, and I moved up to I kept that flight until 41, and then went away to this operational training unit, and eventually there became a squadron leader.
Well, what was the technology developing there, you know, these first few years of the war?
I suppose things were being refined. I mean, we were desperately trying to get people to be able to shoot better and that sort of thing. And of course we're training people at a pretty furious rate. They'd altered the techniques then, because they did their normal flying training, their absolute basic stuff, and then they were sent to an operational training unit where they learnt to fly the operational aircraft and more about it, which is a thing in the early part of the war. There was you didn't go through that. You went straight from your training unit to your operational squadron. But of course it was a waste of time for squadrons to have to devote their efforts to training people, so there were these operational training units, and it served as a sort of weeding out place too.
Well, what did you think of the selection procedure for the RAF for pilots?
Well, it seemed to me very good. Well, yes, they got plenty of people, and the people they got were able to perform satisfactorily. And in general, the Air Force treated its pilots very well, very well indeed. They'd done some very good planning. They'd done some very good pre-war planning, and that carried on during the war. Okay, some of the things they may have done may not have pleased some people, but as far as I could see, it was as efficient an outfit as you could reasonably expect to get. And certainly my contacts with people, I got the impression that They trained the pilots, and it cost a lot of money to train them, and they were going to look after them, and they did look after them. We used to get extra rations, you know. We used to get tins of orange juice and chocolate. Extra. And I think we even got an egg for breakfast every morning, in according to the rations.
That must have been quite a big thing in the war, was it? Seven eggs a week?
Well, later it developed that if you were flying at night, you would come back and you would always have bacon and eggs before you sort of retired to get some sleep and that sort of thing. But I think our rations were very good. We were quite well fed, and we were well looked after.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering also about the democracy within the RAF. You know, one sometimes feels with the Army and the Navy that the officer sort of corps are culled from a particular social class. Did the RAF, you know, did they sort of commission on ability, would you think?
I'm sure they did. Oh, absolutely certain they did.
Were you a great mix of social class, would you say, in the...
Oh, yes, yes. What it really amounted to was, you see, if you wanted to fly, then you had to have certain... You had to have school certificate or matric or something. So that automatically presupposed you'd been educated to a certain level. Now, that rather determined the people you were going to get in your services. But apart from that, it was anyone who was capable of reaching that educational standard and behaved in a reasonable manner, he was there. I know it wasn't a question of class or anything. I don't think that came into it.
How about this sort of Wizzo Prang image as well?
Well, that was a little bit... That was really pre-war stuff. We used to... the sort of Blenheim pilots were the people who looked like that. But of course this jargon that was used, people were young. Because the average fighter squadron was full of very young people, you know, once the war got going. They thinned out fairly effectively. You see, during the Battle of Britain, I think 80% of the pilots were reservists or auxiliaries. Not regulars. It's no criticism of the regulars, because obviously it was the regular Air Force and it was expanding rapidly and the regulars would be needed for that. But it was made up... Oh, there was a complete cross-section and there certainly wasn't any great social distinction or anything like that.
But was there a distinctive culture, would you think? You know, the sort of language, the style?
Oh, yes, yes. Yes, the fighter pilots had their own thing. You see, we used to fly. We used to fly in our ordinary uniforms with overalls on top, you see. This was before you had battle dresses and all that sort of thing. And, of course, in a fighter, you've got to be moving your head the whole time because you've got to watch everything. Because an enemy, when you first see him, is the size of a sort of pinhead over there. A speck of dirt on the windscreen is an enemy in the distance. So you and you had to be aware of what was going on. You had a mirror over the top of your ear so you could see what's behind you. But you had to be alert, and you had to be able to pick things up at a very great distance. And... No, I don't know what I was...
I think you were going to go on to say about your dress, your style of
dress. Oh, yes, yes. Mm. So, you're moving your head, and you couldn't really have a collar and tie tightly around your neck. That was the thing. So you had a silk scarf. Well, of course, all the bomber people used to roar with laughter at this sort of thing. The fighter pilots always had his top button undone and a silk scarf around your neck. But it was practical. It was practical. You wanted that freedom of movement. Of course, the language that was used, I suppose it was perhaps a bit exaggerated at times, but I don't know, it's just part of the scene, that's all.
Did you have sort of words, special words that, you know,
applied to certain things and certain situations and so on, but
Can you think of a few examples?
I can't now, really. I honestly can't.
But if you were together talking, I expect...
It would come out instinctively, but... you wouldn't talk that way now, I'm quite sure, though I don't doubt that you'll find that the pilots in the Air Force have got their own little jargon, their own so on. I think that's to be expected. But there was a tremendous camaraderie about the whole thing, you see. And Fighter Command is a relatively small command, you see. So you've got to know most people. Certainly throughout the war, you got to know vast numbers of people as you moved around, and you knew most of the people. You'd run across them or heard of them at some stage or other. And it was different, and the fighter people were different from the bomber people. Don't ask me why or how. Well, why, simply because the bomber people, you see, were in bigger aircraft with lots of crew. We were just one man in one aeroplane. And at the end of the day, you controlled your own destiny. Well, as with the poor old bombers, they had to look after all these various other people in their crew, and it was a much bigger sort of thing, and I suppose less personal for that reason.
About the fads.
Oh, well, and there were peculiarities of dress. Some of the auxiliary squadrons, for example, they used to sport red silk linings to their uniform tunics and things like that. But it was all good stuff. But the fighter people, it was principally this top button undone. That was traditional. You left your top button undone. And I don't know what else there was, but no, nothing extraordinary really. But the as I was saying, the bomber people probably had their own, you know, ideas, their own dress, and more or less their own language to deal with the job they were doing. We had a particular sort of jargon for the sort of things we were doing.
Could you tell me about your DFC, you know, the events which led
well,
to that?
Well, after I came out of... when I left this OTU, that's at Crosby on Eden, we'd actually moved to Millfield at the foot of the Cheviot. I was posted back onto Ops, and I took command of 609 Squadron, which again was an auxiliary squadron down at Manston, equipped with Typhoons. And that really was another phase, because of course 1943 things were advancing a bit, and people were thinking about going beyond just defending the country. And it was quite interesting. And this Typhoon was a sort of big and powerful aeroplane. It was a brute. And I took over 609 from Roland Beaumont. And his part-time speciality was going beating up locomotives in France on moonlight nights. Just go over and look for a cloud of steam and go and beat it up. Stop the Germans moving around. And when I got there, it was an absolutely first-rate squadron, extremely experienced, first-rate squadron, very high morale. And obviously this has got to be sustained, so I started attacking ships off Holland. And we did our normal work. We were down there, principally on Manston, which you know is near Ramsgate. and we were there as a channel known as Channel Stop. We were there to try and stop anything moving in the channel and way of shipping. And we were also anti-tip and run raids, because at that time we got a lot of tip and run raids with odd or pairs of 190s coming over, because it's nobody at distance, and beating up, well, the seaside towns and there. And we had a couple of aircraft permanently on standby to deal with that during the daylight hours. But and that involved people sitting in their cockpits for very long periods of the day waiting for something to happen. So I decided that we'd got to have a bit more action. And fortunately, the group were very helpful and permissive. So we used to organise our own sorties, and we used to go up to Holland, near Flushing and all the way around there, you see, and look for ships. And we used to do it in the early hours of the morning. Well, we used to take off in the dark, and we took off from Manston and then turned immediately over the Thames estuary and got right down onto sea level and fly in the dark, so that we arrived off the Dutch coast as dawn was breaking. And of course dawn breaks quarter of an hour earlier over there, so and then we'd look for ships trying to scurry up into the Scheldt estuary and that sort of thing before daylight occurred, and we'd attack them. It's had its moments.
These would be supply ships, would they?
Yes, ships trying to make Antwerp. You see, you got the Scheldt to Antwerp and so on. And they'd be moving to Muiden and places like that. And and of course we used to keep an eye on what was going on the Belgian coast, anything coming out of Dunkirk and so on. I know on one particular occasion I had a Norwegian flight commander called Erik Habjon, and he took a group of aircraft and I did. We went over to Holland, and he went sort of up, more or less up in the direction of up the Scheldt estuary to the south of Flushing, and I went to the north. And we found a few ships there and attacked them. We were only attacking them with cannon. And just a nuisance value more than anything else, I suppose. And we attacked one off West Capella, I think it is. Anyhow, it's off the top corner of Isle of Schoon. And unfortunately, it turned out to be a flak ship. And we didn't realise this until I was committed. And that was a bit shattering, because it opened up with everything on me, and I was coming down, and these sort of oranges were flying past me. The shells looked like oranges flying along, just like a glowing orange, and they were flying past. And so I had no alternative but to go on attacking, because if I'd turned, of course, that would have been fatal. I had to keep going straight ahead. And one of these things unfortunately hit me. I didn't realise it at the time. And when I got away, I looked and I saw flames appearing in the bottom underneath me in the cockpit. Because you see, you were up here and there's quite a lot of cockpit down below you. And so I looked out on the wings, and this wing was slowly blistering. So there was obviously something going there, but I couldn't identify where it was, except it was obviously there, and I could see the flames coming out here. I kept an eye on this and headed for home fast, because it's not particularly healthy when you've been beating up ships to come down near the ship. You wouldn't get a very good reception. And the squadron, the other character joined up with me, and we started coming home. And and then the wing buckled with the heat. I thought, oh my God, this is dangerous. And I got somebody to fly underneath me and see whether anything was going on. And they said, can't see anything here. So I kept on going, and this thing kept getting worse. Anyhow, hightailed it as fast as I could back to Manston and got back in fairly record time, and then wondered what to do, because I thought if I put my wheel... Obviously the fire was in the wheel bay, and the wheel bay had a petrol tank on the right-hand side of it, in the wing, and it had a petrol tank in the nose of the wing. So there were petrol tanks on two sides of this wheel bay. Anyhow, I put my wheels down at a fairly good height in case anything happened, because I thought, well, if once I open this wheel bay, you see, the whole thing will blow up, you know, flames will appear. But apparently it did quite the reverse. It blew the flames out, which was very fortunate. So I landed it with no brakes or anything like that. Anyhow, I got it down, and we had a look at the thing. And what had happened is a shell had come into the wheel bay, and it had hit the starter cartridges, which we kept in. The aircraft was started with a Kaufman starter, with things like shotgun cartridges, cordite, and you fired these things to turn the engine to start it. And it had hit these things and set them alight, or exploded them, and that was all the muck I was seeing in the cockpit. That in turn had set a little tank of fuel in the wheel bay there, which was special doping fluid to start the engine too. That had gone up, which had melted the air vent pipes to the tanks, so the air vent tanks, with the heat, you see, the petrol fumes were coming out of this air vent. That was burning like a blowtorch, or must have been, looking at the wheel. So I was very lucky on that thing.
Why did you cling to it rather than bail out? You know, was it important?
I was the other side of the North Sea.
Yes, but when you... when you made land, you were almost home.
Well, I got myself up to a reasonable height, so if anything occurred, I could jump out. And of course I had the other people with me, but I was watching it fairly carefully, and they assured me they couldn't see anything when they flew underneath me to have a look. So I thought, well, we'll just keep going and see what happens.
Is it important to try to get a plane back, you know, or was it then?
Oh, I don't think it's as critical as all that, but you see, I didn't particularly want to be left on the wrong side of the North Sea. And I was lucky. I was lucky. It was as simple as that. And, of course, poor old Eric Habjons, he'd been attacking some ships the other side, and he came back, and he'd got some shells. He'd got one shell, had ripped the front of his nose, his starboard nose tank, in the leading edge of the wing. It just peeled it back like that, and there was a great hole, and there was the petrol and various other bits and pieces, and he landed the thing, and it didn't even catch fire. God knows how he got away with it, I don't know. So that although we'd dealt with a few ships and made life very unpleasant, we'd both had a rather exciting morning.
And you were awarded the DFC, I think.
Oh, not for that. It was just a sort of a accumulation of things, I suppose.
Yes. Well, what is it like getting a DFC?
Well, it's difficult to say. I mean, people are getting them sort of all the time. I mean, it's very nice. It's very nice, but and of course you can have a party in the mess on it, and that's about all there is to it. You stick a bit of ribbon on your corner. But I'd got an AFC. I'd collected an AFC from when I was at the OTU. I think they gave me that because I had a very adventurous flight. We had one of the students crashed in the hills. He was badly burned. And in my particular flight, I had a thing called a Domini, which is a twin-engined aircraft. I'd known, I think, in civilian life as a de Havilland Rapide. And the doctor decided there's only one thing to do with him, since he was very badly burnt, and that was getting down to Cosford Hospital, where they had all the saline treatment and things like that. But it was a filthy day, and the clouds were right down. We were, of course, north of the lakes, Carlisle, you see. So I had a very, very adventurous trip, flying They loaded this man onto a stretcher and with the doc, and we set off, drive down, try and get him down there. But of course, with no aids, no radio aids or anything like that, it was a matter of, you know, a bit of eyeball navigation. And it was a fairly rugged trip, threading your way over Shap Fell and places like that. I was literally going down the road over Shap Fell, and then winding away over the top of Wigan and places. It's very interesting, actually, flying over Lancashire. This is where I used to fly from Barton, you see, and Lancashire is very interesting because it's permanently covered, or was then permanently covered in gloom from all the factory chimneys, and you could tell where you were practically in Lancashire by the smell and the colour of the smoke. And I think you got a sort of soapy smell from Wigan. I don't know whether they made soap in Wigan, but you could tell.